They arrived at the heliport outside Rio. Located on a hilltop, it was a lonely spot, generally used by the military for transport operations. Two Bell helicopters waited on the landing field. Jack Grimaldi and David McCarter were already in the pilot seats. Mac Bolan and Gary Manning would act as co-pilots for the flight to Amazonas.
Better suit up for jungle combat. We're not going on a picnic, fellas.
Enciso and Blancanales were the only Stony Man operatives dressed in civilian clothes. The others had donned tiger-striped jungle combat fatigues, the camouflage uniform favored by the U.S. Special Forces and Marine recon teams. Lyons and Schwartz carried the standard weapons of Able Team, Heckler & Koch 9mm submachine guns, and 357 Magnum Colt Pythons in shoulder leather. Phoenix Force members were equipped with their usual Uzi machine pistols and Walther P-88 pistols. Bolan carried his Beretta 93R and 44 Magnum Desert Eagle. The Executioner, James and Manning also had M-16 assault rifles with M203 grenade launchers attached to the underside of the barrels. An extra M-16 was ready for Blancanales as well. The warriors were all equipped with grenades, knives, garrots, and other weapons of war. Blancanales and Enciso changed clothes rapidly. They pulled on the tiger fatigues, paratrooper boots, and headgear supplied for the occasion. Investigation of Silva's expenses had revealed that he produced military uniforms as well as weapons. The styles included the olive drab fatigues worn by the Brazilian Army and a type of brown and green camouflage uniform with a random pattern. Tiger stripes weren't among the Silva wardrobe, so Stony Man went with that design to avoid confusion in combat.
Commandant Guimaraes says he'd appreciate it if you try to keep the choppers from being shot up too badly. He's going to report them as stolen. That's going to be a big embarrassment, but it will be lessened a bit if they can recover the copters later. Huh?
If we can avoid getting ourselves shot up, we'll see what we can do about getting the gunships back in relatively good condition.
He also said if you can find definite proof Silva is involved in terrorism, he'll dispatch at least 3 companies of amphibious recon marines to head for the site.
I thought we already had definite proof. How much more does the man need?
Enough to justify military action against one of the richest and most powerful men in Brazil. More than tape-recorded conversations, confessions by terrorists, or even surveillance photographs. He needs files, records, actual terrorists located at the base. If you can prove El Cuchillo is there, for example, that would be enough.
That's great. The only way we can do that is by raiding the base and finding that sort of evidence. That's when we can call for the cavalry?
Durao shrugged at the universal nature of bureaucratic red tape.
Tell Guimaraes, thanks a lot.
The Amazon jungle is a different world, one that seems to have been untouched by the passing of time. Although hundreds of acres of rainforest are cut down almost daily, the Amazon region of Brazil covers approximately 1 million square miles. The area Stony Man was concerned with had remained almost unmolested by modern technology, except for the portion where João Silva had constructed his base of operations. Trees and other plants grew everywhere. Myrtles, palms, and various hardwood trees formed a close-knit ceiling with leaves and branches. Alfredo, the Kutai guide, wielded a machete to hack through a tangled wall of vines and bushes. The small, wiry man with nut-brown skin and long black hair was impressed by the 6 foreigners. They handled themselves well in the jungle. Most outsiders would be exhausted after 2 hours of trudging through the rainforest, but these men didn't show the slightest sign of fatigue. The temperature was around 85 degrees, but the humidity in the jungle increased the effects the heat had on the men.
How much farther you figure we have to go?
About 25 miles, give or take 5 or 10.
Think we could contact the guys at the choppers?
Maintain radio silence until we have to call them in. We don't know what sort of radio scanning equipment Silva might have or what kind of range it covers. No sense taking a chance of alerting the enemy until we're right on top of them.
We'll be in the Kutai region as soon. My people do not welcome intruders. If we come across them, I'll explain that we won't be doing any hunting with our guns. They don't like the noise. Frightens game out of the area.
How welcome will you be by your people, Alfredo? Would they resent the fact you left the tribe to live in so-called civilization?
I'm not the only one. My people can't continue to live in the old way. That's probably too bad for them, but it's a fact. The jungles are being consumed by industry, bit by bit. Civilization is closing in. The Kutai will either become part of it or die out. I think it wise that we continue on. We have a long way to travel.
They continued to make steady progress as they chopped their way through the jungle foliage. Blancanales took a turn at point, hacking aside vines with a jungle knife to give Alfredo's machete arm a break. The others followed as the rainforest became even more dense and difficult to penetrate. They accepted the challenge with determination and continued to work their way closer to the objective.
Hey, you guys noticed that? It's too quiet.
Something is wrong.
What the hell?
What is it?
I could have sworn I saw... Ambush!
The others dived for cover as arrows and blowgun darts streaked from the bush. Something struck the ground near Boland's left hand. He glanced at the wooden shaft of an arrow, the head buried in the soft, moist soil. A dart hit the radio transceiver unit strapped to Enciso's back. Another arrow bounced against the frame of the M971 machine gun, the shaft brushing Lion's hair before dropping to the ground.
Brothers! I am one of you!
We have no choice. Open fire!
Operating like men carrying out a well-rehearsed drill, they fired in all directions simultaneously. The Kutai weren't the enemy, and the Stony Man team didn't want to kill any of the Indians. The commandos deliberately aimed high and fired for effect. They hoped that the tumultuous noise and multiple muzzle flashes of the weapons would frighten the Kutai into retreat. Bullets slashed leaves and splintered branches. The bush moved as Indians shuffled from position to position. Two or three hastily aimed arrows shot from the foliage, but none came within a yard of the defender's position.
Move out!
They hurried to the best available cover, taking advantage of the lull in the Indian projectiles to dash for tree trunks, fallen logs, and large rocks. The cessation of arrows and darts could be only temporary, and the warriors knew it. Something sharp pierced Lion's left tricep, and the able team captain glanced at his upper arm to see a needle-shaped object jutting from the sleeve of his shirt.
Shit! I'm hit!
Lion sprayed a salvo in the general direction he guessed the dart had come from and ducked lower behind the log he used for cover. He struggled to stay calm, but it was no easy task, since his heart was hammering like a drum played by a madman. He pulled the dart from his flesh and tossed it aside. James suddenly appeared beside him. The African-American warrior's Blackmore dirk was already in his fist.
Lie still, man. Don't do anything. Leave everything up to me.
Lions obeyed and sprawled on the ground. James slid open the shirt sleeve and examined the tiny droplet of blood caused by the dart. He opened the medic's kit on his belt and removed a scalpel and a small suction device with a rubber ball attached to a short tube. James made an incision with a sterile blade and placed the suction device over the wound. He squeezed the ball to draw out blood and poison.
Carl was hit?
Alfredo, what kind of poison do they use for these darts? Plants, animals, what is it?
I'm not certain what poison they might have used. Lately, I understand the tribesmen in this area have favored snake venom because it can be largely pumped out when bleeding a game animal killed with darts or arrows.
What kind of snakes? Crotalidae or a lapidae?
I don't know what those are. Ferdelance, Bushmaster, maybe a rattlesnake.
Pit vipers. That's crotalidae. Hemotoxic poison. Sounds like that would be it from your description of bleeding game animals.
James inserted the needle of the syringe into a vial of polyvalent antivenin. He injected the serum at Lion's wound. The medic glanced up at the worried expression on Blancanales' face and the solemn features of Alfredo.
Hemotoxic poison is the lightweight division of snake venom. I think our pal will be okay, but I want him to rest as much as possible.
The poison dose probably wasn't very large. When the Kutai hunt with blowguns, they usually shoot as many darts as possible into an animal because one generally doesn't kill it. You probably sucked out all the poison already.
Let's not take any chances.
They must be running out of darts and arrows. Cease fire! Cease fire!
Tell them to back off, Alfredo. They're more likely to listen to you than to us. We don't want to fight them. This is their last chance to let us go before we start killing them. If they keep fighting, they'll be slaughtered.
Please! I am a brother! These men are not dangerous! They only want to pass through safely! Please!
Who is it?
It's Alfredo, brother!
I'm coming forward. Tell the white men not to shoot!
Alfredo! What the hell is going on here?
Cow! Let this man, Belasco, explain!
Why have you come?
We didn't come here to harm the Kutai. We have no quarrel with you, and we didn't start the fight. Why did you attack us when we did you no harm and fired no guns?
You know why. You are soldiers from the evil place. Your soldiers have killed many of the Kutai. You have raided villages and stolen women. Young, pretty women. Sometimes they return after being beaten and raped. Otters have found the murdered in the jungle near the evil place.
Sounds like Silva's mercenaries have been working overtime at being scum. The evil place might be Silva's base in the jungle.
Listen, Cal. We're not from the evil place. We're hunting for the evil place to destroy your enemies. Your enemies may be the men we came to put an end to. Describe the evil place to us.
It is a big village with the kind of magic weapons found on the outside world. They have large huts, lodges, and so many guns. The men wear clothes are spotted like a jaguar, but the colors aren't as beautiful. The clothes are colored like dull parts of the forest.
All right. That's the place we're looking for, and we intend to destroy it because its evil extends beyond the jungle to the outside world as well. Look at our clothes. They're different.
Is this true, Alfredo?
He's telling the truth. I swear it.
I will tell the others.
Dios mío. Make sure your weapons are fully loaded and stay close to cover. We have to stay put for a couple of hours until we're sure Carl is going to be all right.
It was just a pinprick. We can move on.
Not an option. Let's hunker down.
About 90 minutes passed before Carl Lyons was permitted to sit up. Calvin James had checked his heartbeat and found no irregular rhythm. The Phoenix Force medic had also had Lyons flex his fingers, close his eyes, and touch his nose with index fingers, one at a time.
You feel any dizziness, chills, or nausea?
No, I feel fine, Cal. No trouble hearing, no blurred vision, or trouble breathing. In short, I don't feel like I got poison running around inside me.
Okay, but I want you to tell me if you feel ill, confused, fatigued, or you notice any symptoms of poisoning. No macho bullshit, man. Tell me if anything is wrong. Now, I'm going to give you some more antibiotics and water. When you take a leak, let me know if the urine is reddish-brown, okay?
Talk about prying into a man's personal life.
You sure he's fit to travel?
Yeah, I'd rather he didn't, but I can't detect any signs of poison. Iron Man is tough. The poison probably never had a chance.
I'm still glad you were here, Cal. How much longer do we wait?
We can't afford to stay longer. Just to be sure, I want somebody else to carry that machine gun. Carl shouldn't exert himself too much until there's no doubt about his condition.
I can handle it.
Let Manning carry the machine gun. You can operate the weapon when we reach the enemy base. Until then, you'll take it easy.
Movement in the bush drew their attention. The Stony Man warrior swung weapons toward the figures that appeared from the foliage. Manning and Sisu and James covered the backs of the others and scanned the jungle for other dangers, still hidden in the walls of trees and plants. Several Kutai tribesmen stepped into the open. All but one carried bows and spears, but they didn't aim the weapons at the commandos. The unarmed man was elderly. It was difficult to guess his age. His skin was wrinkled, and he had no teeth. His shoulder-length hair was snow-white, and his eyes squinted as if he could barely see.
Who is your leader?
I'll speak for my team.
I have come to personally praise you as warriors, and apologize for the attack by my men. It was very rude, and no way to treat visitors.
The chief clasped his hands together and nodded his head. Bolin realized this was a gesture of greeting or apology or a sign of respect. The executioner had worked with the primitive hill tribes of the Montagnards when he was in Vietnam. Fierce warriors with a strong code of honor, the Montagnards appreciated strangers who showed consideration for their customs. Bolin figured this would apply to the Kutai as well. He clasped his hands together and nodded at the chief.
It is an honor to meet you. We accept your apology. We're sorry for shooting at him and his men, but we were merely trying to defend ourselves.
Understood. We trust that you have come to destroy the evil place. That is a good thing. The men with me have volunteered to help you. They are my best bowmen and spear fighters. They want to go with you.
They know the way to the evil place?
They know where it is, and they are eager to take you there.
Thank you, Chief. Your warriors are welcome, but they have to understand that they must follow orders from us.
Understood.
Huge walls surrounded Joao Silva's jungle base. The thick brick was painted brown and green for camouflage from a distance. Nets hung with fake foliage had been strung between posts to create a type of camo ceiling. Some palm trees inside the compound provided further concealment from the air. Bolin observed the base through binoculars. He couldn't see much above the walls, but a pair of radar dishes were visible atop a building. The heavy wooden doors of the gate were big enough to allow vehicles to pass through, and a crude road extended for several miles into the jungle. He noticed that uniformed figures patrolled the top of the walls.
That's a pretty impressive accomplishment in the middle of the Amazon jungle. Too bad Silva didn't choose to put his energy and ingenuity into a more worthwhile ambition.
A little late now, Iron Man. Wonder what defenses they have besides the guards.
Wouldn't make much sense to use motion detectors or heat sensors in a jungle. Too many large animals and plants that sway in the breeze. They'd be checking alarms every 5 minutes. The walls would be pretty good protection against most threats. At night, they'd probably use floodlights or maybe infrared.
We can only guess what sort of weaponry they have inside. Silva's an arms manufacturer. You can bet he supplied his base defenses with the best he could come up with.
We'll find out fairly soon. Alfredo, it's time for you and the other Kutai to head back. This is as far as you come.
I thought we'd help you with storm of the fortress.
You're not trained for this sort of operation. This isn't a matter of courage. If we could draw the enemy into the jungle, you could help us fight. However, we have to go into the evil place where guns and bombs will be used. We can fight such battles better on our own.
Will we know how this turns out?
You'll hear about it one way or the other. If everything works out the way we plan, Dorao will give you a somewhat edited version of what happens. If we fail, well, let's not think about that.
Well, good luck, my friends.
The Kutai were obviously upset that they had been ordered to return to their tribe without doing battle with the enemy. Yet they had vowed to follow orders, and they reluctantly headed for the bush, with Alfredo last to go. Bolin had waited 10 minutes to give them time to get clear of the fortress before he told Enciso to switch on the transceiver radio. Just sending a radio broadcast on any frequency might alert the enemy if they were monitoring wavelengths with sophisticated equipment. Blancanales was the only member of the group who had a working vocabulary in Portuguese. An English transmission might seem suspicious. He knelt by the radio and keyed the mic.
Quiero una cerveja.
Saúde.
They left the radio on. The signal would help Grimaldi and McCarter locate the area. If anyone had monitored the brief conversation, they would have heard one boy say he wanted a beer and another guy introduce himself as Moreira and tell the thirsty fellow the Portuguese equivalent of cheers. An odd conversation, but they hoped that no one would suspect that these were passwords and signals.
Okay, let's get ready. The gunships are inbound, and we better be ready to move when they get here.
The Stony Man soldiers had planned their strategy before moving into position. They broke into two-man teams. The Able Team and Phoenix Force members had considerable experience working together, so Lyons and Blancanales moved to the rim of the jungle near the west wall of the fortress, and Enciso and James covered the east wall. Bolin and Manning took their positions by the north side of the base. Bolin watched as activity burst into life within the fortress. The nets above the compound were hastily pulled away. The camouflage covers had been set up like giant curtains and parted by guidelines and pulleys. Bolin and the other veterans of Vietnam immediately recognized the sound of helicopter rotor blades. The memories associated with choppers and Nam were too vivid to be forgotten, and the sound would be with them for the rest of their lives. Silva's choppers rose from the base. They were small and sleek aircraft with pointed snouts, resembling flying sharks. Bolin identified them as smaller versions of the Huey Cobra, probably Silva's own personal modification. The two craft headed south. Another pair rose as soon as the first cleared the area. All four moved in the same direction. Although small, the choppers were equipped with machine gun mounts and aerial rockets. It was a lot of firepower.
They must have picked up McCarter and Grimaldi on radar.
Can we warn them with the radio?
They'll know in a matter of seconds anyway, Gary. Our guys in the sky are on their own. So are we if they can't get past those four flying killers.
Holy shit! They've sent a welcoming committee!
Gadget Schwartz shook his head as he peered over Jack Grimaldi's shoulder and out through the windscreen.
Wonderful. Can we take him? Do we have a choice? Get strapped in and prepare for a real roller coaster ride.
Grimaldi realized they were in trouble. His gunship was a Bell UH-1D, bigger and heavier than the enemy copters. The smaller craft would be faster and able to maneuver better than the Bell. The only advantage Grimaldi had was the fact that he was armed with machine guns and rockets as well, and the Bell had a larger arsenal than the modified Cobras. The superior numbers of the enemy made that advantage questionable. Of course, David McCarter piloted another Bell UH-1D. The odds were 2-1. Both the British ace and Grimaldi were superb chopper jockeys. It was doubtful the mercenaries flying the other rigs had a fragment of their skill or experience. Grimaldi decided to find out. The enemy was still out of range, but he triggered a short burst of machine guns mounted at the nose of the Bell. The smaller helicopters scattered and returned fire, the bullets falling far short of their mark. One Merc pilot launched a rocket. It streaked through the sky, exhausted energy, and plunged to the jungle below. Whoever they were, they had little, if any, actual combat experience. That was another plus on the side of the Stony Man warriors. One enemy pilot decided on the bold approach. He kept his course directly at Grimaldi, strafing with his machine gun. The Stony Man flyboy turned the Bell swiftly to present the side of his chopper to the opponent. Bullets raked the fuselage. Grimaldi hoped the Bell was more sturdy than the enemy's lightweight craft. He quickly completed the turn and opened fire with his own guns. Bullets smashed the windscreen of the aggressive copter. The pilot was cut to ribbons, and the aircraft spun out of control, performing an awkward series of circles as it plummeted down. Grimaldi gambled that the fallen copter would startle and distract the remaining opponents. He immediately rushed the nearest chopper, firing his guns. Slugs hammered the body of the smaller craft. The pilot swung the nose around and returned fire. Grimaldi had already climbed higher into the sky, anticipating the enemy's response, and locked on target with his rocket. The projectile slashed a white line across the sky and slammed into the upper carriage of its target. Flaming debris descended to the treetops like some ghastly rain from hell. McCarter continued to head north as if trying to slip past the enemy. One aircraft gave chase, confident he could outrun the slower, heavier Bell. The enemy pilot let loose a salvo of machine gun rounds and struck the fuselage of the Britain's Bell.
My God! I hate flying, and I hate being shot at when I'm flying even more. Try not to think about it.
McCarter raised the Bell and turned in the air sharply. The Briton executed this maneuver because he guessed that the enemy would launch a rocket in an effort to finish off the Bell. His assumption proved correct, but the pilot had fired his missile too soon. The projectile sizzled beneath the landing gear of McCarter's helicopter. The Briton was glad the enemy wasn't armed with heat-seeking missiles, or the trick wouldn't have worked. He turned to point the nose of his Bell at the aggressor and fired his machine guns. Slugs shattered the window by the pilot and tore into his face. More bullets struck the controls and ricocheted within the copter. The pilot didn't have a chance. Wounded and unconscious from massive shock, he slumped in his seat as the helicopter tumbled out of control to crash to the earth. The remaining enemy aircraft blasted McCarter's gunship with a long burst. Bullets raked the tail pylon, broke the horizontal stabilizer, and damaged the tail rotor. McCarter worked the controls, but the gunship began to whirl in wild circles. McCarter was almost distracted by the sight of Grimaldi launching another rocket and scoring a direct hit broadside on the enemy chopper. Silva's Warbird exploded in a shower of metal parts and burning fuel.
Brace yourself. We're going down, mate.
Going down?
Rather fast.
The gunship fell. The rotor blade helped slow the descent, but the helicopter increased speed as it plunged to the treetops. It hit the branches, limbs cracking under the massive weight. The helicopter crashed through the branches to land heavily on the ground.
There. We landed.
Grimaldi headed for Silva's stronghold. From his position in the sky, the pilot clearly saw the compound. With the nets to block his view, he scoped the buildings, motor pool, and airfield within the brick walls. He was astonished by the size of the base and the amount of equipment below. The motor pool contained 3 trucks, 4 Land Rovers, and 2 odd-looking armored vehicles. 2 helicopters remained at the airfield, Boeing Vertol CH-47 choppers, better known as Chinooks. The workhorse of helicopters, the Chinook could carry in excess of 7,000 pounds more than 100 miles without refueling. So large, it required 2 rotor blades, a Chinook could serve as a transport craft and carry 44 passengers. Grimaldi had a pretty good idea how Silva had managed to haul in the manpower and construction materials for the base. The enemy had been busy. The main house was a mansion, 2 stories high and made of brick with a camo-painted roof. four billets were also located at the base. Each was large enough to house 30 to 50 troops. Sandbags formed bunkers near the barracks. Dozens of uniformed figures raced about the parade field below, many swinging assault rifles toward the Bell chopper. Other mercs were positioned along a catwalk at the top of the protective walls.
Time to rock and roll!
He triggered the machine guns and sprayed the mercenaries with twin streams of 30-caliber rounds. Bodies toppled, torn by high-velocity slugs. Survivors of the first run dashed for cover. Some returned fire, but Grimaldi kept the chopper beyond effective range. It was easier to fire down at a target than to shoot at one 2,000 feet in the air. Grimaldi picked his targets with care. The Chinooks wouldn't be able to present a threat without announcing they were about to lift off. The rotor blades were motionless, so Grimaldi didn't have to worry about the big helicopters at the moment. Instead, he targeted rockets for one of the barracks. They blasted the wooden structure to pieces. Another volley of rounds slashed more mercenary gunmen and sent corpses sprawling across the parade field. Grimaldi was creating a superb distraction for Boland's unit to launch their attack on foot. The executioner and Manning jogged from the jungle. The Canadian sharpshooter raised his silencer-equipped M16 and nailed a sentry in the chest. The guard convulsed from the impacts of the trio of 5.56mm slugs and fell from the top of the wall. Boland stood watch as Manning moved to the gate. The Canadian placed a prepared charge of C4 plastique by the thick wooden doors. The demolitions expert set the timer and moved away from the gate. Both Boland and Manning hustled from the gate and took cover along the wall. The C4 blew the doors apart as if they were made of cardboard. As he ran, Boland watched a huge Chinook up ahead explode in a shower of flying metal, spraying flaming fuel across the airfield. Boland and Manning saw Grimaldi's Bell gunship swing in a semicircle to launch two more rockets at the motor pool. The three trucks and four Land Rovers burst apart into fiery wreckage. Boland and Manning headed for the main house. Mercenaries at the east wing of the fortress were startled to discover Rafael Enciso and Calvin James. The Phoenix Force pair charged through a crudely made opening in the wall and fired on a trio of unprepared mercs. The warriors moved to cover by a stack of bricks kept for the purpose of repairing walls. They scanned the area, taking in the scene. Fires burned from Grimaldi's rocket attacks. Many dead mercs already lay on the grounds, and others scrambled in panic. Lyons and Blancanales entered the compound from the west wall. Three mercenaries still had their backs turned to the gap in the barrier, their attention fixed on the invading helicopter. Lyons caught sight of one holding a rocket launcher similar to a Soviet RPG. The guy braced it across his shoulder and knelt, weapon aimed at the gunship. Lyons saw the man's finger go to the trigger. Just as he swung down the heavy barrel of his M971, the Merc slumped to the ground, the unfired launcher landing beside him. Another Merc whirled, startled by the sudden appearance of the commandos. Blancanales quickly whipped a rifle butt stroke to the second trooper's temple, rendering him unconscious. A third hard man pivoted, a submachine gun in his fists. Lyons slapped his MG across the barrel of the Merc's weapon, deflecting the aim of the subgun just in time. Bullets tore harmlessly into the ground, and Lyons slashed the toughened end of his hand across the gunman's throat. The guy dropped his weapon and staggered backward, hands clutched to his throat, eyes wide open in terror. The karate stroke had crushed the Merc's windpipe. He was choking as he lost consciousness and slumped to the ground. Blancanales scooped up the discarded rocket launcher and braced it across his shoulder. He peered through the elevated sights and drew a bead on the nearest barracks. The projectile streaked across the parade field. The warhead blasted at a wall, knocking down the roof on the Mercs inside. As Blancanales rose, he spotted two men climbing for a window of the main house. He didn't recognize Rico Gomez and Guillermo Aguilar. The representatives of the cocaine cartels had decided that the best chance of survival was to slip out of the house, find a hiding place, and escape while the raiders and Silva's mercenaries were busy fighting with each other. Blancanales could tell that they weren't regular grunts because they were dressed in suit trousers and dress shirts. Blancanales raised his M16 to his shoulder just as the pair caught sight of their assailants and stopped abruptly. Gomez whirled and pointed his Glock 9mm pistol at the Able Team pair. The 5.56mm slugs ripped into the Colombian's chest. He landed on his back, a diagonal line of bullet holes stitched across his shirt front. Aguilar dropped on his belly next to his slain companion. He realized he was pitted against men far better armed than he. Aguilar tossed away his six-hour autoloader and shoved the briefcase he carried across the ground toward the warriors.
Keep your hands in view!
English? I speak your language, mister. I'm glad you are here. Silva kidnapped me and has been...
I bet. Get up. Slowly.
Aguilar started to rise. Suddenly, his foot seemed to slip, and he fell to one knee. The Bolivian dropped his hands to his leg, as if trying to rub the bruised knee.
Don't even try it.
Look, I'm not part of this. Look in that briefcase. You'll find proof that I am innocent.
Check it, Paul. And you, get up.
Sure.
Aguilar nodded nervously as he slid his hand down to the .25 caliber Raven in an ankle holster. He suddenly threw himself sideways and thrust his arm at Lyons, the tiny pistol in his fist. He hoped the tactic would catch the man off guard and allow him to pump two or three slugs into the big gringo's face before the mysterious gunman could adjust the aim of his weapon. Not even close. Lyons unleashed a stream of parabellums into the Bolivian's upper chest, and two 9mm rounds smashed through his upper teeth and the bridge of his nose.
Dumbass. What's he got in that briefcase?
Money. Lots of bills. Lots of currencies. What should I do with it?
Leave it with these two. Money was probably the reason they threw in with Silva. In a sense, they died for it, so let them have it until somebody else comes along.
Works for me.
Venga aquí!
Joao Silva gestured wildly at a pair of mercenaries as he stood outside the mansion, surveying the devastation. The mercs obeyed the order and hurried to their boss. The arms merchant felt as if he were staring at hell itself. The barracks and airfield were destroyed. Every vehicle in the motor pool was crushed, except for the two miniature tanks. Fires raged throughout the base, and the majority of his mercenary force was already dead or otherwise taken out by the invaders. He still had no idea who was attacking the base. Silva glimpsed the gunship circling the compound, picking targets and firing machine guns and rockets. Silva scanned the parade field, hoping to see slain invaders among the corpses. Every body seemed to be clad in the uniform of his security forces.
We're being cut to pieces, Mr. Silva!
The merc's face was pale, and he was obviously close to panic.
Get the fire extinguishers and put out the blaze so I can get to a tank. Do either of you have experience with the vehicle? No, Mr. Silva! Pathetic. Put out these fires!
Silva would have to handle the tank himself. The arms merchant didn't know what had happened to Gomez, Aguilar, or Cazazo, and he didn't care. The cartel representatives weren't fighting men, and he didn't expect them to be much use in combat. Cazazo talked as if he were a courageous fighter and a master strategist, but Silva no longer had any faith in the terrorist. They had all failed him, Silva thought bitterly. His hired mercenaries didn't seem to be faring any better than his forces abroad had. Damned cowards and idiots. Silva pulled on a pair of gloves as he watched the merc spray the motor pool fire with white foam. There was no one he could rely on now but himself. He marched through dense smoke to the nearest mini-tank, covering his nose and mouth with a sleeve as he climbed up to the hatch. He climbed into the seat and locked himself in. Surrounded by the steel armor and bulletproof plastic shields, the Brazilian felt protected. He also had fearsome firepower at his command. The tank had recently been equipped with a short-range cannon, as well as twin machine guns in the turret.
If I'm going to die, I'll take some of these bastards with me.
Explosions erupted within the mansion, windows blowing apart at both ends of the building. The enemy had invaded Silva's headquarters. The place was more his home than the ultra-expensive ranch house he owned in São Paulo.
Damn you!
A 30mm shell burst from the stubby barrel, drilling into the second story at the front of the house. The explosion blew off part of the roof and took out a corner of the brick building. Silva's second round blasted a wall beneath the first explosion, causing a cascade of brick tumble from the structure.
That will give them something to think about. Now let's deal with the other scum.
The tank rolled toward the mansion, Silva guiding the vehicle toward the French doors to his den.
What the hell was that, Rafe?
I'm not sure I want to know.
Enciso and James had hit the rear of the house as Bolin and Manning entered from the front. Grenades were used to clear the way before crossing thresholds. James and Enciso had encountered a few mercenary soldiers in the house, but the enemy had been stunned by the concussion grenades and presented little resistance. However, something else was awaiting them in the room next door. The pair crept closer to the entrance of the den. Enciso guessed that one of the Land Rovers had gone out of control and crashed into the mansion.
Oh, shit!
James jumped back and instinctively raised his Uzi at the tank. Bullets sparked on metal and ricocheted against the shatterproof plastic dome. Enciso advanced and unleashed his own barrage at the mechanical monster. He concentrated his fire on the dome, aware that the term bulletproof was relative. Any surface could be penetrated by a projectile if the material was subjected to enough molecular stress by repeated pounding. The 9mm Parabellum rounds didn't seem to be troubling the odd little tank. James had left his M16 outside because the rifle was awkward in close quarters. The Uzi had seemed a better choice for inside the house. But the 5.56mm ammunition wouldn't be any more successful against a tank than 9mm, and James couldn't use the grenade launcher when they were so close to the armored vehicle. The smiling face of Joao Silva stared from the transparent dome of the tank. He squeezed the triggers to the machine guns, and a steady stream of rounds blazed from the barrels. James and Enciso leapt away from the vehicle and dived to the floor. Silva's smile faded as he worked the turret to adjust his aim. His quarry were too low and beneath the line of fire. Enciso rolled into a corner and reached for a grenade on his belt, his hand froze in place. Maybe an M26 fragmentation device would damage the tank, but it would just roll off the metal and plastic curves of the machine. The Cuban would be more apt to blow himself up than stop the tank. James jogged backward down the corridor. Silva swung the guns of his turret toward the African-American. James leapt for shelter behind a long leather sofa. Silva wasn't certain if he hit his prey or not, but it didn't matter. He could run the tank right over the sofa and crush it, along with the gunman using the couch for cover. Enciso quickly stripped off his fatigued field jacket and ran to the rear of the miniature tank. He had stuck two M26 grenades in the cargo pockets of the jacket. The Cuban had a plan, and he would only have one chance to see if it worked. He jumped onto the back plate of the tank and quickly slung the jacket over the plastic dome. Silva's entire line of sight was now obscured.
Look, son of a bitch, what are you doing?
With the jacket temporarily secured in place, the Phoenix fighter reached into each pocket and wrapped his fingers around the pins of the grenades with
what
each hand.
What the hell? Run!
Both men dashed outside through a side door, throwing themselves to the ground and covering their heads. Enciso got to his feet first. He stared at the den. The tank had run into a wall and appeared still mostly intact. Dust swirled within the room, but the Cuban saw that the dome was missing from the vehicle. The grenades had blasted it to bits, along with Joao Silva's head. Bolin pushed back the rubble. A wall had crashed down on the executioner and Gary Manning. The unexpected cannon shell fired by Silva had knocked plaster and brick onto the Stony Man warriors. Bolin grit his teeth as the pain in his left arm commanded more attention than the assorted bruises suffered in the incident. He flexed his fingers and was relieved to discover that his hand wasn't broken.
Manning!
The warrior knelt beside the inert figure of the big Canadian and placed two fingers to Manning's neck. He found a pulse, which was strong. A lump on the Phoenix Pro's skull revealed he had been hit by a brick when the wall caved in. It was hard to tell if the man had sustained serious injury. The executioner glanced about the hall. Debris littered the area, and sunlight streaked in through gaps in the walls. He wondered what had happened. Someone must have set off a bomb. He would find out later. For now, he had to stay alive and complete the mission. A figure appeared at the end of the hallway. Bolin's hand reached for the 93R and shoulder leather.
Freeze!
The man moved closer, and Bolin saw a pistol in the man's fist. He also recognized a lean, cruel face and the trademark trench knife sheathed on the guy's hip.
Del Cuchillo, I thought you would have left before we had hit this place.
You knew about my involvement?
You left an impression on a couple of your victims. Your friend Arashi had a photo of you two as well.
Arashi is dead?
Killed in a sword duel. He had enough guts to fight with cold steel.
I thought you were supposed to be a Blade Man, too.
I have my moments. Who are you? You're American, and you're carrying an interesting choice of weapons. It looks like a Beretta, and one of those big 44 Magnum pistols. Perhaps the Executioner isn't dead after all.
Perhaps not. If you want to go for it, squeeze the trigger. It'll be all over. Of course, you wouldn't be talking if that was what you wanted.
I always wondered how good you really were, Executioner. Everyone knows you're an expert with firearms and explosives. But I always suspected a man like you wouldn't be much without his guns and grenades.
I've got a knife. Interested in putting your reputation on the line instead of running off at the mouth?
Get rid of the guns. Very slowly. Use the thumb and forefinger to draw the gun by the butt. No tricks. I'd rather kill you with my blade, but I'll use a bullet if I have to.
Kazazo nodded and gestured for the warrior to move closer. He backed up as he led the executioner away from the weapons. The spacious hall left ample room for an arena. Kazazo tossed aside his pistol. Sunlight gleamed across El Cuchillo's double-edged blade. The brass-knuckle hilt formed a cestus around the terrorist's fist. The executioner unsheathed his K-bar. The combat bowie knife wasn't as fancy as El Cuchillo's weapon. The blade was a few inches shorter, and the handle wasn't equipped with knuckle dusters. Kazazo appeared amused. The knife was standard for U.S. military personnel, he realized, which probably meant the executioner was an amateur with a blade.
I guess we're both legends. One of those legends will today come to...
The executioner attacked. Kazazo delivered a thrust to meet the warrior's lunge. The executioner anticipated the move and hoped to draw out his opponent. He dodged the knife thrust and delivered a karate snap kick to the terrorist's gut. El Cuchillo doubled up. Bolin slashed his combat knife at the side of the guy's neck, hoping to cut the carotid artery, but Kazazo whirled and struck out with his own blade. The sharp steel sliced the warrior's sleeve and bit into his forearm. Bolin retreated. Kazazo followed his attack with a roundhouse kick to the executioner's left side, nearly knocking the warrior off balance. El Cuchillo swung his trench knife fist and punched Bolin in the left triceps with the brass knuckles. The terrorist fainted with the trench knife and hooked another kick to the warrior's belly. Bolin doubled over as his breath seemed to freeze inside his lungs. El Cuchillo was almost disappointed. He had hoped that the famous executioner would be more of a challenge. The terrorist prepared to plunge his knife into his opponent's kidney. The warrior suddenly braced himself on his right fist, K-bar still firmly in his grasp, and lashed out with his left leg. The iron broom technique clipped El Cuchillo across the ankles. Kazazo rolled away from Bolin, no longer underestimating his opponent. Both men got to their feet.
Not bad, executioner.
El Cuchillo attacked again. His style was similar to fencing techniques, Bolin noticed, as he danced away from the trench knife. Kazazo's double-edged blade was designed for thrusts more than cuts. Bolin avoided a short stabbing motion and slashed his buoy at the guy's wrist to try to disarm him. El Cuchillo shot a right hook to Bolin's jaw. The executioner staggered from the punch. Kazazo lunged toward the warrior's heart with the trench knife. Bolin sidestepped the attack, and Kazazo's momentum carried him past his adversary. The executioner swung a hook kick at the small of Kazazo's back and sent the terrorist hurtling face first into a wall. El Cuchillo whirled and slashed wildly to keep Bolin at bay, but Bolin's boot slammed into the terrorist's wrist. The knife fell from Kazazo's broken hand. Bolin dove forward, driving his knife into Kazazo's solar plexus. The force of the lunge drove the terrorist back into the wall. Bolin's right shoulder shoved under Kazazo's extended arm as he jammed his K-bar deeper. The executioner left the knife in the corpse and pushed away from Kazazo. He looked at the infamous terrorist as the man slid to the floor. Death of a legend? Bolin knew better. The executioner and El Cuchillo were just men. One of them was a terrorist, and he was now dead. It was the end of a bloody and vicious career. Kazazo had paid for lives taken in the past, and he would take no more in the future. That was good enough for Bolin. David McCarter and Yakov Katzenellenbogen had some trouble finding their way to the fortress. When they arrived, the battle was over. A handful of surviving mercenaries had been rounded up and secured with riot cuffs. Manning had regained consciousness and suffered nothing worse than a headache and mild scalp wound. They spotted Grimaldi, who was wandering around examining the scene, and they approached him.
I wonder what happened to you two. Saw you go down. You both okay?
Aside from nearly having a heart attack, looks like you've got everything taken care of here.
And we bloody well missed it. Where's Silver? Managed to take him alive, Rafe?
What's left of him is still inside his toy tank. That thing won't shut off till it runs out of fuel.
That's okay. We found some records of Silva's involvement with the terrorist conspiracy. We got all the evidence we need to make the president and the Brazilian authorities happy.
What do we do with the prisoners?
Leave them, Paul. We'll call Guimarães and tell him to come pick them up. He can consider it compensation for losing one of the choppers he lent us.
The Commodore will take credit for this. He'll come across as a hero before this is over, and they'll probably promote him to Admiral.
Cheer up, Iron Man. We know what really happened. That's what counts.
What counts is we completed the mission and put an end to the conspiracy of international environmental terrorism. We're all still alive, and none of us got any injuries that won't heal. That, my friends, is worth more than any medal or ticker tape parade.
Stony Man 6 is a graphic audio production. Stony Man, The Executioner, and Mac Bolan are trademarks owned by Harlequin Enterprises Limited, used by others under license. Copyright 1993, Worldwide Library. All rights reserved. Production copyright 2009, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Performed by Richard Rowan, Terence Aselford, Nanette Savard, Thomas Penny, Christopher Graybill, Jeff Baker, Peter Stray, Eric Messner, James Konacek, Michael John Casey, David Coyne, Michael Glenn, Ken Jackson, James Lewis, Tom Simpson, Tony Nam, Michael Glenn, Andy Clements, Joe Brack, Elizabeth Jernigan, Karen Carbone, and Mort Shelby. Additional red shirts performed by The Dead Giveaways. Directed by Terence Aselford. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing by Greg Reinfeld. Graphic audio sound design by Brian Rogers, Temeskin Wubna, and Greg Reinfeld. Book adapted for graphic audio by Matt Jacobs. With original music by Temeskin Wubna. If you enjoyed Stony Man, be sure to look for Don Pendleton's Mac Bolan and the Executioner, available at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net.
Available now from Graphic Audio.
Wraith is a patrol ship. She's been in combat against the Blood Horde. We're jumping out to meet them.
Forward hull breach. That'll mean decompression injuries in the nearest compartments beyond the breach.
For all we know, Wraith won't make it until we arrive.
What happened?
We got hauled in as casualties. We're on the DSR.
We're going to be discovered soon. We don't fit in with these...
slaves.
Careful. You still have to do it.
In my sleep, pack leader.
Hey, Serrano, you hear about the mysterious intruders?
Intruders?
Don't move. We don't like Serranos, but we do recognize your value as a hostage. For now.
The Wraith crew members who came aboard as casualties from the forward compartments have not appeared for ID checks. I understand that Lieutenant Suiza had a notion that they might be Blood Horde intruders.
We need to get our combat experience people over to T3 and T4. There's got to be another way to get through this.
If we can't go inside, how about outside?
Trouble. They're maneuvering. Lieutenant, I don't suppose you know whether the FTL drive is irretrievably broken.
The FTL drive.
It should be interesting.
Got a plan yet?
A two-part plan. Get control of this ship and defeat whatever's waiting for us.
For which we need warships.
If only we could Trojan horse them, the way they did to us.
It can't be done.
Do you really think our people can't figure out the controls on Blood Horde ships? I think they can. I think they will.
Prelim scan, 6. Say again, 6 Blood Horde ships.
We did it! We got ourselves a warship!
Let's get this ship going. Weapons, range in, Captain. Go ahead.
Serrano Legacy, Book 4, Once a Hero, Part 2, from Graphic Audio.
Graphic Audio presents DC Comics, Justice League of America, Wonder Woman,
Mythos.
When Hermione and Chloe read to you out of the ancient texts, daughter, did they ever read you a story about an island of men?
You really think there is an island of warriors in this ocean?
Oracle?
Batman, something big just came up. I mean that literally. An island just popped up out of nowhere.
Magic.
I hate magic.
Tonight, we set sail for Themyscira, where our weapons will taste blood.
Superman, you are possessed by Ares.
You ruined everything.
Who the hell died and made you queen, huh?
Come, Diana, puppet of Ares. One of us must die now.
I'm sorry, Mother.
Kill her!
No!
Now, the world will burn.
Copyright 2009, DC Comics, all rights reserved. Justice League of America, Wonder Woman, and all related names, characters, and elements are trademarks of DC Comics.
If you can't find that hot graphic audio title you're looking for, just head to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD or MP3 disc format. Or, the fastest and cheapest way, download that puppy and play it on any of the many devices that'll play Windows Media. And if you're on the road or just a total computer feeb, snatch up the phone and call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net.